Would you please welcome Roy to the back?
Well, in the words of St. Francis as he greeted St. Dominic on the road to Assisi, hi. It's really good to be with you and appreciate the welcome. And never mind little Bangor, I'm a Celt, I'm a Northumbrian, and I give thanks to God for St. Deniol and the Welsh saints who together with the Irish brought the good news of the gospel to my part of the world, Northumbria. And as a Celt, I'm indebted to the Scots, for it was there in Scotland that from an unchurched background as an outward bound instructor in the Cairngorms I came to faith, and then catapulted into marriage and Bible college and then to university in Cardiff. So I thank God for that experience. And I indeed walked round Splott many years ago and around the docks when the docks were not yuppified as they are now. And so it's lovely to be back in Bangor and have very fond memories of this place. We have four children and five grandchildren, not Catholic, just irresponsibly Protestant. And our eldest, Ben, was at university here studying forestry, and he is in forestry. He's a senior manager with the Forest Service in Ireland now, actually working on things like the ash dieback disease and its prevention. But my wife Shirley and I, we drove over. It's a long way from the northeast by the Scottish border to here. We drove over and we left our son, and we are quite a close family. And it was kind of like, I think Shirley and I drove back the 6 hours north, hardly saying a word. We were just worried about our son, that kind of rites of passage moment as you hand him away. And it really was before the days when everybody had mobile phones. And we didn't hear from him for 4 days, so we were like, you know, oh, how's he getting on? Because he was a little distressed about us leaving him, you know. And we needn't have worried, because within half an hour, he met Judith, and they've been married for 11 years. And he did ring on about the fourth day and say what a great time he was having, and have you met some new friends? Oh, yes, one in particular, and that was it, really. And what was so special, and it's actually, is it Freshers Week this week or next week? This week, is actually the welcome that the church gave to students. Because Ben brought up in a Christian family, but it was here in Bangor that he kind of owned the faith. And this faith flourished under the encouragement of the church and the Christian Union here. So never underestimate the welcome, hospitality and ministry that you have, because Ben and Judith have gone on to serve the Lord. They're involved in a very lively big church in Belfast. They have three children. Ben's part of a study group. He's involved in all kinds of things. So never mind small Bangor. It might be small and, like the northeast, get written off by lots of people, but in the eyes of God, this is a very special place, and it's a place of great influence. So lovely to be with you. Lovely to see you and stay with Peter and Susan again. I think the last time I stayed at your house, actually, my mum and dad stayed. They've since gone on to glory, but they too were here with happy memories of Ben's graduation. Slight sad story in that. You remember my other son, who was here, Joshua, he was beaten up in Bangor on the afternoon of Ben's graduation. And he then accompanied a policeman driving around. And what you don't want to do is beat up Joshua, because he's got photographic memory. So he was able to kind of spot those who, you know, attacked him. And, you know, that was a sad incident. But you know, God redeems all things. He sends his greetings to Bangor. He doesn't feel too badly about the place. And I saw him on Wednesday. He's now a tutor at Spurgeon's College, London, teaching people and training them in theology for ministry within the church. He's the academic in the family. He's got his mother's brains. So there you go. Great to be with you. And first impressions, the garden. I just want to say that I travel all over Europe visiting all kinds of churches and communities, and I'm very conscious of first impressions. I love the garden outside. This is the gardeners here. Right. You are to be commended, because actually as a visitor, first impressions count. And it's a beautiful garden, and actually never minimize the kind of aesthetic quality of environment and buildings and design and that. So bless you in that, and keep up the good work. What I want us to do this morning is just to take a look in the first session a little bit about the context we find ourselves as believers and the church in a changing world. I was with a Channel 4 film crew yesterday, walking some of the Cuthbert Way with Tony Robinson, the guy who was on Time Team and Baldrick and all that kind of stuff. And, media people, they just think the world revolves around them. And there was so much wasting time. But in the wasting time, there was an opportunity to chat. And at one point, while we were waiting for the right light and the right sound and everything else, we had this conversation. What was your first album that you bought? And the first album, the LP that I bought, was Bob Dylan's. And it's a picture of Bob Dylan, a young Bob Dylan, and it's got "The Times They Are A-Changing." Now, that was in the 1960s, but it's so apt for today, 2013, because we're living in phenomenally changing times. And what I want to just paint in broad brushstrokes now is that I believe that we are living in an emerging post-Christendom society. That the Christian faith that was at the heart of Welsh nation and culture for so many centuries and the rest of Britain is now just one little story among many stories and narratives. That we actually are a minority people, and times they are clearly a-changing. I was talking to one of the film crew, one of the cameramen. They were a canny bunch of people, actually. And, he was saying, how do you get into all this faith stuff, It sounds really kind of interesting what you're saying about St. Cuthbert and that. He had not been brought up in church whatsoever. How do you get into it? And I shared with him I came from an unchurched background. I was in the Cairngorms of Scotland. And like the Celtic saints, creation was the fifth gospel. God spoke through his creation. And certainly God used my experience of being in the mountains to speak to me and to bring me to faith. And actually, I kind of in those days, which is over 30 years ago now, 40 years ago almost, I kind of made my way into the context of a church to find out more. And I shared that with him, and he said, "Well, why do you go to church? Why do you go to church to find out about God? It would be the last place he would have gone." And he wasn't winding me up. He genuinely didn't make the association between church and spiritual and God. For him, the church was just like, it was okay if you're into that kind of thing, but he was a spiritual man, but not church. And I thought, gosh, there's a little illustration in advance of coming today about the missiological task that we face. There's a lot of people now, 40 years on, who wouldn't, if they were seeking God, think about coming over the threshold of a church. Just wasn't on his radar at all. Christianity has moved from the center in many ways to the margins, from the majority to the minority, from occupying a place of privilege. We're just as a faith one of many different faith and worldviews. And, it was okay under what was called Christendom to kind of, teach the word of God and preach and pastor and care for people and maintain the church, and people would come in. Folks, that isn't going to relate or connect with culture today. If it does, it might reach about 6 or 7% of the population. That's a Christendom culture. We're in a post-Christendom culture where we've moved from community to individualism. Where we've moved from the concept of society cohering together around certain set ideals and values, it's now about self-fulfillment and personal choice and preferences. And the big philosophy of our day is no longer Christianity in the West. It's consumerism. And it's interesting. I mean, I don't know if Tesco's was here when I came 7, 8 years ago. It was. I must have come in the other way, and I didn't notice it. But it's really interesting when you drive around Britain and around Europe, and you see now the modern temples and places of worship. They're supermarkets. And even some of the supermarkets are designed with like little steeples on them in the entrance areas, and the kind of steeples that go up. Certainly Tesco's and I think it's Asda or Sainsbury's that actually have gone for that kind of design plan. I shop, therefore I am, is the kind of motto of contemporary culture. And we've lost what's called the meta-narrative, the Judeo-Christian story, that people like Daniel and the Celtic saints here in Wales, they brought a story that brought transformation and shaped European culture. But we've lost that. And now we're just, as the writer Stephen Law had said, we with our enduring story are in a culture with endearing myths. And people chasing after myths. So, that's the context. I didn't mean to kind of cheer you up, but that's the context. And it's a missiological context. And actually, you know, talking to the film crew yesterday, I realized that here were people who were on a very different world trajectory to me, but actually they were seeking people. And I actually find it easier to talk to people about spiritual things today than I did 35 years ago. Because when you speak to people, you know, 35 years ago, people thought that they knew the faith. So it's kind of like, yeah, I know what that's all about, and I've rejected it. There's a whole generation of, particularly people under 40 years of age, for whom the Christian story is just not known. I will do an assembly where I live in the Cheviot Hills of Northumberland, as I do regularly, but at Christmas, and I can guarantee you, I get the people, tell me the Christmas story. And they haven't got a clue. That is not an exaggeration. They haven't got a clue. One or two kids will know it's something about Jesus, but they could not tell you the Christmas story. They don't even do the Christmas story in the schools now. They don't do the kind of Christmas carols and things because it's non-PC. And that's in rural North Northumberland. They don't know the story. If you ask them what book tells us about the Christmas story, they're more likely to say the Argos catalogue. The missiological challenge. Now that's the context. There's also opportunity in that as well as challenge. But what we're going to do in this first session is to ask, in the light of that, what is church? Does anybody else like Father Ted? Just think it's great. I do a lot of training and speaking at theological colleges, and I use DVD clips of Father Ted all the time. And I love Father Dougal. You know, and one of his oft-quoted phrases is, what's that all about then, Ted? Right? And actually, I want to ask a Father Dougal question. The church, what's that all about then? What's the church all about? See, to that guy yesterday in the crew, what's church all about? Kind of get this stuff that you're talking about God and faith and spiritual living and spirituality and wisdom and all that kind of stuff. What's the church all about? The missiological challenge demands that we ask, what do we mean by church? Because the church as we know it in the West is changing. My favorite definition of leadership is that which is quoted by Max Dupré, who's a great leadership guru. And he says, the first task of leadership is to define reality. It's a great definition of leadership, to define reality. And the reality is that the church in the West is declining. Now, you might be part of a church that is seeing growth and life and seeing people come to faith, and thank God for that. But the reality is the church in the West is declining. And, you know, I remember 1980s, you know, having come to faith and evangelical, get touched by the charismatic renewal moments, renewal movement. So charismatic, evangelical, activist, doing the stuff. Busy church, singing songs of revival, lots of students in Sunderland, good church planting in Portrack before that on Teesside, very exciting. Step outside the little culture of the church, and the reality wasn't revival at all. Decline. And despite all the songs that we sang, and all the words that we preached, and all the prophecies that were given, revival didn't come round the mountain like she comes. It actually signaled decline. The reality was, in the 1980s, 1 million people left the Christian church in Britain. Actually, not in Britain, in England and Wales. So kind of like Alpha, and the Catholics had their decade of evangelization, and we had Tell Jim and Tell Bob and Tell the Second Cousin's Third Auntie's Mother. You know, all that kind of stuff. Lots of initiatives. But in the 1990s, a further 1.5 million people left the church in England and Wales. Where I live now, is back in an area where Shirley and I, we went to Bible college in Berwick in Northumberland, and college teams used to go out into the chapels and the churches of North Northumberland. In Glendale, where I live, which is, it's not Greendale to be confused with Postman Pat, in Glendale, where I live, there were 11 full-time, what we'd say, clergy. And there were 27 churches, assembly halls, congregations, chapels. There are now 11. And there's 2.5 times people in ministry. 2.5 people in ministry. Or you get half a person in ministry, but you know what I mean. The reality is declined. Please, if you're taking notes, there's no connection between me learning to preach all those years ago and the decline of the church, all right? But this is the reality. In Glendale, where I live, my eldest daughter, Jessica, is living with us for 5.5 months because her husband, Nick, is away in Arizona training to be a BA pilot. So they've rented the house in Oxford. We have Jessica and the two little ones living with us. Jessica takes the little ones to the church. And the church is in Woola. They're ecstatic to see them. Because they haven't seen a young family in their church for over 20 years. The average age, I would say, of the churches in Woola, of which there are 4 churches, is probably late 60s. I'm one of the young people. Please don't laugh. I am one of the young people in the church in Woola. And that's partly why we established a missional initiative called Crossing Places, which I might allude to a little later on, about planting the gospel and seeing what happens. So defining reality. Now, I don't know what Wales is like, forgive me. And, you know, if you're part of a thriving revivalist context, you're the exception. Because the reality is that the church is declining. So in the light of that, and its missiological challenge, what do we mean by church? And I want us to go back to the early church, to take a look at scripture and to do a little bit of theology. And it struck me as I woke this morning and I pulled the curtains back, and it's just fantastic. The vantage point from Peter and Susan's manse is just brilliant. It's one of the best views in Britain, isn't it, for manses? You pull the curtain back. And to be honest, I sat on my bed and just stared for about 15 minutes. It was great, the mountains. And I was thinking about the early church, thinking about what I was sharing with you, and thinking about the early church and thinking, actually, you know, they didn't know what the church was. You see, those early disciples, they didn't have a concept of going to church. The day of Pentecost, the Holy Spirit didn't come upon them and say, oh, let's go to church. The church was birthed, but they didn't really know what it was all about. They didn't certainly begin with a building. There were some things that happened in the temple courts, but they didn't begin with a building. They didn't begin by saying, we know the answers. No, the church then was simply a bunch of people who'd been touched by the living God. Yeah?
If I may, you've used a jargon word 5 times so far.
Go on.
Which some of us may not understand properly. Missiological.
Missiological. Okay, very good. Thank you. Peter, can you explain what Miss Noah said? Put it in its broadest terms. It's to do with the mission of the church. Our task, if you think about the great commandment, is to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind and strength. The great commandment. The other great commandment was to go into all the world and make disciples. So the missiological task is the church expressing the heart of God missionally. Thank you. Thank you for raising that point. So, everybody got that? Is that okay? Okay. Missiological. All right. Ah, not mythological. No, I put my teeth back in. Okay. Then missiological. So, we're talking about mission. But I intentionally use, now that we've got it understood, missiological, because I don't want us to confuse mission simply by doing evangelism. Because for some churches, not necessarily your churches, evangelism is us going out and, you know, delivering the good news to people on a mission. And actually what I want us to encourage you to see this morning, that it's much more about the whole of life. It's not an activity. The missiological challenge is the challenge that actually the world at large does not know about the good news of Christ. That's the missiological challenge. And the church is facing that missiological challenge. So the early church begins with people who actually are just trying to respond to what God's done in their lives. They don't have an idea of what church is. They haven't got all the answers. And they kind of work it out bit by bit. That's what the story of the New Testament is, isn't it? It's not only a kind of geography book of Paul's missionary journeys. It's a story about, like, wow, what does it really mean to follow Jesus and to be open to his Spirit? We don't really know what it actually means to be church, but actually the Spirit of God is at work among us. And they had a few concepts from the Old Testament, but the new and early church was very different from the rites and passages and ways of Old Testament. What did Jesus mean by church? If you read through the Gospels, you see that it's quite difficult to draw a picture that of Jesus establishing an institution, as people might found a religious club or a political party. I always get this mixed up. It is Saunders Lewis, isn't it, who founded the Welsh Nationalist Party in the last century. And he had the idea about Welsh political independence. And he set about creating a structure that people would then be invited to, so they could sign up for with at their meetings and have their membership lists and their subscriptions, and they could go out. He established a kind of institution to bring about reform. But that's not how Jesus did it. Jesus didn't establish and say, let's create an institution, let's create a club, let's invite people to join it, give them the things that they need to do to join. Sometimes we've made church feel more like a club, but that's not the way of Jesus. But Jesus did do something, didn't he? He said, I'm going to build my church on people like you, Peter. Jesus didn't just kind of, you know, proclaim salvation and then say to people, get on with it. And then a bunch of people got together and said, we don't know what we're really doing, so let's have a meeting. Let's put a big building up and decide what we want to do. No, what Jesus did, he comes into the world as an expression of the very heart of the Father God, and he creates relationships, a community. And he invites people to enter into the kingdom of God, to embrace a new way of life, to enter into relationship with this God who before that was kind of mysterious. And if you wanted to get to know this God, it was rites and rituals and sacrifices. And only special people could get there. And only certain people could enter. But now Jesus said, you want to get to know God? Get to know me. A different way. And then from this small little group of people, a motley bunch really, I mean, they were northerners, to be honest. This works well for you if you're ever preaching in the south of Wales. Works brilliant for me when I'm in the Bournemouth and the south coast of England to remind them that the disciples were northerners. And there was only one southerner among them. And really, you haven't got time to expound on Judas at this point. Went down a storm when I preached in Bishopsgate, London about that. All right, that was one of those occasions where you preach once and know you'll never be invited back. But they were a motley bunch of people. And God called these people into a new relationship with himself. And then that relationship underwent such trauma. Because the leader of the pack got betrayed. Not only beaten up and tortured, but actually was crucified as a criminal. And yet to this bunch on the third day, Jesus appears. And therein sows the seeds of the beginning of the church, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And Jesus didn't institute a church. He didn't kind of say, well, here's an institution now. But he creates relationships. And that's what God always does, isn't it? It's what God always does. Doesn't give a message from on high, but comes and delivers it and creates a people, calls people into relationship with him. Jesus, John's Gospel, the Word becomes flesh. He does what God does, creates relationships. And the church is actually about God bringing people into relationship with himself. The church is a community of those who are finding new relationship with God and with one another and with the world. So the church is the arena in which the effect of Jesus at work is worked out. And when Paul, he's an apostle and he's trying to make sense of the church and he's wrestling with it. He starts off by persecuting the church, doesn't he? You know, and it's true throughout the history of the church that when the church becomes an institution and when the church becomes very powerful and when the church starts to decree rules and regulations, what it wants to do away with is Jesus. And that's why the church really struggles at times with apostles and prophets, because they say things that are irritating and challenge the status quo, just as Jesus did. So when Paul, he's wrestling with these things as a persecutor initially of the church, and then his Damascus Road experience, he now becomes an apostle, and he's trying to work all these things out. And what he says is that the church is a new creation. It's something that God creates through bringing people into a living relationship with himself. Not an institution designed to further a program, nor an association of people who happen to have the same ideas, but the church is a way in which God begins the process of newly creating the earth and redeeming what is. That's a big concept, isn't it? It's like God saying, I redeem the world through my son Jesus. Jesus who comes announcing the good news of the kingdom. Jesus who brings people back into a living relationship with God. Jesus who reconciles people, whose lives were broken, whose lives were bust. He brings repair, restoration, healing, renewal, and deliverance to. Jesus dies, Jesus rises from the dead, Jesus ascends into the heaven, Jesus sends his Holy Spirit and says to this motley bunch of people who've come to know and to love and to serve him, you are my people to continue the work that I have begun. That's what the church is. Big agenda. I have a Quaker friend, and I love the term that Quakers use. They are the Society of Friends. It's brilliant. I wish we Baptists had bagged it before they did. I think it's great. Actually, probably under the Trades Description Act, we probably couldn't do that as Baptists, because often we're not very Society of Friends. But it's wonderful, isn't it? Jesus, in forming the church, creates a Society of Friends. Think about the disciples. Think about the power of God's good news to take people who were once enemies and turn them into friends. Matthew the tax collector, Simon the zealot, they were opposite ends of the political, cultural spectrum. Simon the zealot was a terrorist. He was a guy who refused to kowtow to the Roman authorities and empire that had come and occupied his country. Matthew the tax collector worked for the Romans. He was a Jew, a Roman collaborator. Do you think that when Jesus called them, they just got together and sang, "Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love"? Or "Bind us together, Lord"? No. I have this sneaking suspicion. You know when Jesus sent them out in twos? Do you ever think this? I mean, I'm a bit wicked, is it? They're like, "Matthew, you go with Simon." You go with Simon. And it says, when they came back rejoicing. But what they don't say is that Matthew came back very tired, because he daredn't sleep in case Simon the zealot backslid. Went to default ways. I have a sneaking suspicion that whether it went on or not, the reality is that Jesus turned people who were enemies into friends. And the first sign of the kingdom of God, the first mark of the church, is friendship. Friendship with God, friendship with others. So if you're looking for marks of the church in the 21st century, let's return to the marks of the early church. People who were on opposite sides now become friends. When I came to faith in the Cairngorms of Scotland in the 1970s, I went back. There weren't many churches in the Cairngorms or the North Sea where we were sailing. So I went back into the staff room at the Outward Bound School at Burghead on the Moray Firth. And I'd come to faith around the Easter time, and I knew there were two people who seemed a bit religious to me, so I asked them that if they were Christians, and they both said yes. And I said, well, I've been told by these people who I was with when I came to faith that you need to kind of disciple me. I think that was the term, you know, foreign language, right? And they did. It was great. Now here is the wonder and the miracle of the story. The first person who discipled me, one of those instructors, a guy called Doug, who was from Brethren background, and he gave me a great love of the scriptures. We used to have to weigh people's rucksacks before going into the mountains, including the instructors, and you were allowed 52 pounds, which is a sack of potatoes, maximum allocated weight. Well, his Thompson Chain reference Bible was half the allocated weight. Absolutely enormous. And I thank God for him, because he gave me a real love of the scriptures. It was before the days of highlighter pens, but nevertheless, he underlined things. And he used to have in the margins, TP. I used to think, what was that all about? Tried and proven. It's great. Gave me a love of the scriptures to this day. But here's the other marvel and miracle. The other member of staff, who was a Christian, was a Catholic, charismatic. And he taught me that it was okay for men to passionately love Jesus. And he taught me that actually it was really important that my experience of Jesus wasn't the only experience. And that everybody else didn't have to conform to my experience of God. And actually there was something in the Catholic tradition which was rich and deep and profound. And he taught me to be open to the Spirit of God, to the mystery of God, and to the wonder of God, and to expect God to work in my life and in the world today. And of course, actually the miracle was not so much that I got discipled, but the people who were former enemies, theologically, discovered they were brothers in Christ. Now, you can understand why God used that experience, deeply formative in my coming to faith. That's why I'm part of a community that's got Protestants and Catholics, and about half of our community who are unchurched or de-churched people. And people who are seeking, but who don't know what they are. Well, they know who they are, but they don't kind of align themselves. Rowan Williams, who was the last Archbishop of Canterbury, who indeed was Bishop of Wales, wasn't he? And before that, he was Bishop of Monmouth, and we used to draw some of his writings in the early days of the Northumbria community. He talked about, well, the church needs to wake up to the fact that the biggest people group in religious circles in Britain today is the unchurched and de-churched believer. And folks, there are thousands of them. Thousands of them. How do I know? Because hundreds of them come through the doors of our community's mother house, year in, year out. It might not be what we want. It might not be ideal. We might, in some circles, brandish them backsliders, but Rowan Williams says we have to wake up to the reality of what is a movement and hear what God's saying to people who no longer associate with the institution of the church, but who actually are quite serious about faith and God. When there were just a few of them, we could call them backsliders. But the fact that many of them outnumber, there are more unchurched and de-churched believers where I live in North Northumberland than all the church congregations put together. This is a sociological phenomena, a reality. And we're called to kind of relate to those folks, to be the society of friends, to model to them and to the world that God makes a difference. God transforms our relationships, breaks down the barriers. I think it's a month ago. No, 3 weeks ago, on a Saturday morning, another beautiful Saturday. Hasn't it been a gift this summer? Isn't it continuing to be a gift this autumn? Went cold a couple of weeks ago. We thought this is autumn. Then it's gone mild again. It's fantastic. The biggest problem we've had in the Cheviot Hills this year is like fires. because it's so tinder dry, but we can kind of cope with that. But, you know, I was walking 3 weeks ago on Saturday on a peace and reconciliation pilgrimage over 8 days from Durham Cathedral to Flodden. Now, Flodden, 500 years ago, was the place of the big battle between the English and the Scots. It was the most violent, bloodiest battle that scarred certainly Scotland and soured relationships between England and Scots to this day. In 4 hours, as we ended up on the battlefield on Tuesday, at the place called the Killing Fields, where there was a solemn commemoration that we were leading, we remembered how in 4 hours, 13,600 people were slaughtered, the vast majority of whom were Scots, including their king, King James IV, a good man, a Christian man, who was actually warned in a dream not to go to battle in his palace in Linlithgow, but he still went. Very sad story. Why were we doing peace and reconciliation? Because underneath the surface, in the subcultures of our lives, in the consciousness, there are inbred hatreds and intolerances and kind of prejudices that alienate us from one another. And with the whole debate about the referendum next year, we had four groups of people coming from where the Scottish armies assembled, and four groups of people, I was at the Durham leg, coming from where the English, and we came together for peace and reconciliation. And it's a sign of the things that I'm talking about here. God wants to reconcile us to one another. And the second characteristic I want to suggest of a church, first one, society of friends, but manifesting out of that, is reconciled relationships. See, there would be people in your church who you wouldn't associate with outside of Christ. But Christ has brought you together. That's a sign of God's new creation. I had a really interesting time. I was in London this week. I was at Spurgeon's College and for a day. And as I'm coming back through London, I see in the tube somebody who I know, who's a friend of our community. And I'm sat there, and he's actually an MP. And he actually works in the Foreign Office. And he's dealing with all kinds of stuff at the moment, Syria and the Middle East, and just awesome stuff. And we were just talking on the tube. Now, his political ideology, I was joking with him, not on this occasion because it was far too serious, but when we were together a few years ago at Spring Harvest, his politics are to the right of Genghis Khan. Right? Now my politics are considerably more left, considerably left of centre. So actually, ideologically and politically, we are poles apart. But in Christ we are brothers. That's really important. And there are people who worship God in different ways. They were trying to question me yesterday, Tony Robinson, the difference between Roman tradition and Irish Celtic tradition. I'm saying there were differences, but it was one faith. And yes, the Celts, I believe, it was damaging the Synod of Whitby and the decision to go with the Roman ways and not the Celtic ways, but it was the one faith. And we have to wrestle with those things. Wrestle with the differences. And let's bring it down to the very reality. You know, no doubt this church was a congregational church.
Presbyterian
church. No doubt it had an organ somewhere.
It's now in Norway.
Right, okay. But, hey, what have been one of the big theological debates over the last century? Organs or guitars? Pews or chairs? And you know, it's often, I think God sometimes uses those debates to test out whether relationships are real or not. Because the history of the church is fallout over things like colour of chairs, carpets, or organs or worship. God have mercy upon us. If Jesus can bring a zealot and a tax collector together, then we really shouldn't be falling out over the colour of carpets. Or even denominations. It's fantastic. You see the people from other churches here. It's really, really good. Welcome you, and we honour you in our midst. And I say that as a Baptist pastor. You know, for Catholics, Presbyterians, Methodists, URC, Anglicans, You are very welcome. I don't like to take a chance on it, but that was supposed to be a joke. We are united in Christ. That's our calling. That's our calling. We Baptists do not have the monopoly on truth. And when we say we do, our pride ruins our soul. We can bring things to the table when we're invited, but we don't have monopoly on truth. There is one who has the truth, and his name is Jesus. It's not us. So characteristic is to be society of friends, reconciliation. Paul writes about the church being a sign of the new creation, of God's means of reconciling all things to himself. So you see, in a diverse, fragmented culture, in a culture of fear and insecurity, in a culture where under economic restraints and austerity, the church models a different way. I think I'll share about this tomorrow morning when I'm preaching. I think one of the responses we should be making as a church in this economic recession is to live generously, to reflect the nature of God. And, you know, there is economic recession, but actually most of us, we can manage. Just go to Africa and see what recession is like. Just as my friend Martin talks about going to Tanzania and, you know, teaching in the schools in music and, you know, rejoicing actually over a certain part of Tanzania that because of the debt cancellation from Bill Clinton and Gordon Brown many years ago, it's less impoverished. But the still day is when kids will fall asleep, and it's because they will eat when they get home tonight, but they didn't eat yesterday. That's the poverty levels. And we're called to live generously. We're called to live in a fragmented world, to say, actually, there's a way of getting on. The combativeness of so much of present culture is I find frightening. I mean, our democracy is, our politics are based on adversarial stuff, aren't they? And actually, it comes into the church. One of the real struggles that we face in churches is actually to debate anything. Because if somebody says something that's different from you, then we regard them as deviant. Or we get all emotional about it, and then we can't tackle the issue. It's all really emotive stuff. Let's have a church meeting and let's discuss homosexuality. Let's talk about charismatic worship. Let's talk about issues of wealth and poverty. We don't talk. And yet the Society of Jesus is called to talk. It's called to share. It's called to celebrate diversity. These are signs to a watching world of the redemption of God realized through his church. And that's what happens. Churches where Jesus is at work, these things will be manifest. Now, I began with that kind of biblical, theological picture because I want us to get back to some of the fundamentals of what church is all about, so we can answer Father Dougal's question, what's that all about? So that from time to time, we can imagine what the beginning of the church was like in terms of God's recreating the world, a kind of giving us inklings of his new creation, of new relationships made possible through him. Only as we see the church in that light do I think what the principle is against that we have to try to live out church today. A few years ago, what do I mean by that? A few years ago, a long time ago, in 1982, when I was church planting, first pastor of a church on Teesside on a council housing estate. It had been a mission hall up to that point run by the big Tabernacle Church in the town centre. And they'd run kind of missions, and they'd had a gospel evening service, and a Sunday school, and a woman's bright hour. It was pretty miserable, actually. It was like a dark hour, but, you know, I'm sure in its early days it was a woman's bright hour. And, you know, we're doing this stuff, and we had Lewis Misselbrook, who was a really godly guy with his wife, Molly. And I think he was head of the Department of Mission at the time. And they came and spent 10 days with us in the church. And I thought they would do like lots of mission things. Well, They did a few things, but basically they just wandered around the estate. And they obviously came to church and shared a little bit, but they basically spent most of their time just wandering around the estate and meeting people and talking with them and getting into people's homes and drinking lots of mugs of tea. And then they fed back to the church. And basically what they were saying is, look, what would Jesus do? And it was a very simple template, before there were any wristbands, what would Jesus do? Very simple thing. Do you think Jesus would organise a bright hour? Do you think Jesus would have a gospel service? Do you think Jesus would run a Sunday school? I mean, they were legitimate questions, and there were good things about some of those things. Do you think Jesus would, like, organise the way you've got your home groups organised? And they weren't critical. They were those really subversive people who were really nice, but you felt uncomfortable by the questions that they asked. You know, how can somebody so nice be so subversive? That was brilliant for us in 1982, because actually it caused us to ask the question, what is church? Why are we doing what we're doing? Because if it doesn't serve people encountering Jesus, let's not do it. And what Lewis said to me is, and I've shared this with lots of people training for ministry, Roy, Jesus didn't call you to run a church. Jesus called you to be a fisher of men and women. That's his words. And then it made me think about David Watson, who used to be the vicar of St. Michael of Belfry, who, when I came to faith and came back to Harrogate, where I was there living at the time, went across to some great services at St. Michael of Belfry in the late 70s. Mid-70s. And David Watson used to say, you know, God has called me to be a fisher of men, but the church wants to be a keeper of the aquarium. And what I'm trying to get at inadequately is that we need to just keep gently, not negatively and critically, but gently just asking ourselves, why do we do what we do? And if we do things that actually don't reflect the heart of God and are not environments in which men and women are encountering Jesus, then we've got to ask, why are we doing what we're doing? Does that make sense to people? It's not to destroy the church, but to help continually reorientate the church back to the reason why we are to be church. I remember saying, but we have quite a good children's Sunday school. Yeah, that's really great. But you're living in a culture where unemployment has risen in 1980 from 22%, which was a real challenge. It's now 53% 3 years later. The rise in mental health issues, the breakup of families, the fears, the alcoholism, the gambling, the shops are shutting and the loan sharks are coming in and the betting shops are moving into the area. This is a society that is fragmented as a consequence of unemployment, actually of policy that just discarded whole communities. Please don't tell me that policies don't impact individuals and communities. They do. I work with a psychotherapist. I mean, I'm with her in this. I don't need to go and see her. All right? But and when I say to her and share with her some of the stories and narratives that I heard from the people whom I was caring for and pastoring on that estate, she said, yes, that's like the victims of abuse. I hear the same stories from people who've been raped. So it was serious stuff. And families were fragmenting and they're saying, great that you do what you do with a Sunday school, but do you think Jesus might do something for families? And that's how we started every month to have family picnics, which of course weren't just for mum and dad and kids. They were things that brought people together. Out of that we learned that, you know, we used to do this kind of monthly thing that was like overtly evangelistic, to which we invite people to come to. We were very innovative. We had film nights. It's very innovative in the 1980s, have a film night. Well, actually, the only people who came in the main were Christians. because we were in a culture where people wouldn't come over the threshold of the church. Even at funeral services, there were men who would stand outside the church. They wouldn't come in. We had a dedication service once. I always used to insist that parents, relatives, if the parent was known, they were all there for the dedication. We were the only church in the area, so I was a bit like, I was like the priest, I was like the vicar, the rector, I was the minister, I was the pastor. So I always got asked to do things, which I was very happy to do. But I used to insist that all the family was there. And I remember, still remember vividly, at Portrack Baptist Church, a dedication. There's a big family at the back. It's about 30 of them come on mass. You know, sit there. And all sat at the back. Some of them standing at the back. And one guy was so nervous that he gets out his papers and he gets out his baccy and he's rolling it. And he's like having a fag at the back of the church. And you know, it's to the eternal credit of Portrack Baptist Church that nobody batted an eyelid. That's a bit different, isn't it? So he sat smoking like this. Because at the moment he starts, got the fag in his mouth, he feels a little bit more relaxed. This is an alien environment to him. But nobody came to these film nights. And then somebody suggested, well, this is a culture, that this is a society that just like feels kicked into touch. Can anything good come out of Portrack? So we created an arts festival. Worked with the schools, worked with the people, discovered people had gifts and talents that school and education and the workplace and society never said they had. So the Portrack Festival came into being. It moved from art festival to a community festival. And we got Pam Royal, who was from Tyne Tees. She was the pretty presenter. She's still pretty pretty, but she's in her 60s now. But she was very pretty all those years ago. And we contacted her and said, Pam, we need you to come and open this. And then we got a telephone call from one of the secretaries from Tyne Tees to say, well, why? They said, because everybody loves her. And this community needs a bit of love. And she came. And she opened the first Portrack Community Festival. And what we were trying to do was to say, what would Jesus do? What we were doing in the festival, we were trying to bring colour back into people's lives who'd turned grey. What we're trying to do was to say to people who felt worthless and just rubbish about themselves, actually, you're made in the image of God, you're creative. And some of that, it sounds strange to say this, but you know, one of my memories of those early festivals was some of the poetry that came out from the lips, they couldn't write it, from the lips of men who'd worked in the steelworks and in the shipyards, who felt discarded. It was like emotional catharsis. They were able to write about the rage that they felt and the despair that they felt. And they didn't, one poem, I don't want to get on my bike. Because you're asking me to get on my bike and leave my children and leave my mother and leave my father. And the bike I had was nicked. And the bike I had was nicked, was sold for scrap, and put food on my neighbor's table. That's powerful poetry. And the church made the space for people to articulate what they were feeling. What would Jesus do? What's the church all about? So let's just take a look for a little bit at some of the church's programs, or structures if you like. They have to serve the essence of the community. It's party conference time, isn't it? And you probably guessed, I actually do belong to a political party. But I don't go to many branch meetings because they're about 18 miles away. And the other reason I don't go to branch meetings is because they're barbaric. If I ever think a church meeting is bad, it's good for me to go to a political branch meeting. I mean, to be honest, there's a bit more honesty in the branch meeting. There's no pussyfooting about, but it does like sometimes feel as if you've done three rounds with, you know, whoever the latest international boxer is. It's just brutal. But one of my friends still goes from Wooler to the branch meeting, and he just had enough of it. And he said about 2 or 3 years ago, he said, if you think this is serving the Labour movement, you want your heads examining. This is the last meeting I'm attending. I'm standing down. And actually, I'm going to resign my membership. It was a clarion call. He's now the chairman of the local branch. And there are young people in that branch now that would never have set foot, never been part of a party. Because the structure had alienated itself from the original chapel meetings. The whole idea of meeting together to talk about issues of righteousness and justice and how we're going to live and how we're going to protect and how we're going to, you know, pursue issues of international good relations. All that had gone out the window, and the structures, and it all became like proposition and proposal and second motion and politics in the worst sense, fighting. Now, we can say that's what politics do, but the church has to be careful that its programs and its structures and its way of doing things doesn't kill the life out of what the church is supposed to be. If you'll excuse me for a moment, those who are not from a Baptist church, Baptist churches have members' meetings. And sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad, and very occasionally they're pretty ugly. I think one of the huge challenges for us as Baptists, and actually for people who have congregational form of government, is actually how we do church in a world that people do things differently. In our associations, in Baptist associations and in life, we say, isn't it a shame there's no young people go to any of these things? Why don't the young people come to our assemblies and our associations? I'll tell you why. Because young people don't relate the way we do. They don't do agendas and meetings and assemblies like we do. They don't even network and relate like we do. Bill, who's with me, friend, he's a missional pastor in Glendale. We called him nearly 3 years ago now to come and plant the gospel. And to come alongside us and help plant the gospel. And we were organizing a party for children in Glendale. And he put posters up, and he put notices, and he put cards through. And, you know, from his perspective, and one or two other people on our initiative, the whole of Glendale knew about this party. But he was getting a bit worried, because only 10 or 11 people kind of registered to come to this party. He happens to mention it to a young couple who were part of our initiative, and they put it on Facebook. And within 3 hours, there's over 40 people signed up for it. And they buzz with other people. That's just a silly little illustration. But they communicate and network differently. So the idea that we can kind of, you know, publish papers in advance and get people to read screeds of papers and sit together in rows like we're doing and like have somebody bring a proposition, it's just not how the world below 40 actually relates. So they're challenges for us. So we've got to ask ourselves, the questions and the programs we have, are they actually communicating the values that the church is all about? Are we as a church organized in such a way that it looks as if God's new creation is happening? Are the programs and patterns that we have, do they allow that basic event of encounter with Jesus to happen? David Watson, wasn't it? You know, he talked about in the renewal movement in the 90s, of like, it was like God's kiss of life to a dying church. And I think it was David Watson who talked about on one Pentecost Sunday, you know, if the Lord withdrew his Holy Spirit, 90% of the churches would just carry on. There's the line of a famous hymn, isn't there? And still the holy church is here, although her Lord has gone. It's a terrible line, isn't it? It's kind of like, well, we'll carry on regardless. We can't be the church if Jesus isn't at the heart. We can't be the church unless the Lord, who is the giver of life, the Spirit of God, is at work among us. And when our programs and our protocols actually begin to determine and no longer be the means of serving that, then it's time to question them. The person I most admire this year, do you know who it is? It's Pope Francis. Now let me tell you the story. If you're of a nervous, conservative, evangelical disposition, just either don't listen to what I'm going to say, or just hold on to your neighbour tightly. It'll just be a few minutes, all right, as I tell this little story. I was at the International Baptist Theological Seminary in Prague. I was there for 6.5 weeks, early part of the year, February, March. And we were sat in the Jaranelka pub, which is just up the road from the seminary, which is often staff and students do on an evening. And we're sitting there, and then the guy behind the bar, the Czech guy behind the bar, says, is looking at the television, says, "White smoke." There's white smoke. So out comes the mobile phone from one of the staff at the seminary, and he's got on his iPhone a thing called the Pope app. So like we're all downloading the Pope app, and it's absolutely brilliant. And here for me is where God will not be contained. I'm a Baptist, evangelical, charismatic, who's part of a new monastic community, and I then am back up in the chapel because we just felt we should go back into the chapel of the seminary, put our pints down, drank, and then put our pints down, and then we're back up in the chapel, and we're sitting there, and we're broadcasting through the data projector, through the computer, and we're watching Francis. And we're all kind of interested. And Francis comes out, and the seminary, about 40 people at the occasion, went into silence. And then we spent the next 2 hours praying as Baptists for this man of God, who exudes something of the spirit of the name he's taken, Francis. My good friend, who is a Catholic priest, says, "Please pray for Francis." "You do pray, I know you're a Baptist. Pray for Francis." I said, "Well, yeah, I will. I might not do it always publicly in church, for fear I get shot." And then he said, "That's why I want you to pray for Francis's protection. Because he is returning the church to the simplicity of the gospel, and in so doing, challenging and subverting some of the papal practices, some of the Vatican policies. He is carrying God's heart for the poor. He's the guy who said, when the delegation were going to come from Buenos Aires, don't come and spend money on a plane fare, give that money for the poor. He's the guy who's got rid of the Pope mobile around the Vatican and the nice flash, was it Lancia car? Have you read this? And he's bought a Renault 5. Was it Renault 4? Renault 4. Every French farmer's dream car in the 1970s, and if you had a little bit of extra money, you could buy one with a heater. Now what he's doing, it's a prophetic symbol. Because what he's saying is, to a world that is so saturated with status, you need a car to get from A to B. He's not travelling all over Europe in it, but he's travelling the Vatican in it. And thank God for him and people like Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who did an amazing thing in Durham Diocese in the short period he was there. Durham Diocese is now a missional diocese. Thank God for the Justin Welbys and the Pope Francis's, who actually have the bottle to say, we have to find a different way of financially running the world. Because we have made money an idol. And when you make something an idol, you give it deity and power. And the financial markets are what are determining the world in which we live. And the financial markets are creating wealth, but they're not trickling down to the poor. They're not feeding the hungry. They're not sheltering the homeless. And we need to question the immorality of the marketplace. Thank God that religious leaders, apostolic and prophetic people, are starting to speak out. My brother, who is a really nice guy, he's a God-fearer, he wouldn't say he was a Christian. He's a season ticket holder at Newcastle United. Yep. But when the Wonga thing, the sponsorship, was on the shirts, right? My brother wrote to Newcastle United and said, I am not renewing my season ticket. He has a 2-year season ticket. So thank God did 2,500 other people. And Newcastle are having to take some notice. Wonga's very clever with its advertising. Have you noticed that? Two nice old ladies in cartoon form. And then when they interview professional, young professionals who say, no, it's really good. Do you know people who are in debt to money launderers? Their lives are crippled. Absolutely crippled. Do pray for, there's a new bank being formed, isn't it? There's the sell-off of RBS, which we own incidentally. But they're working, that some of the branches have been sold off, and they're going to be formed with a bank that's being established by the Church of England. A different way of doing stuff in the world. And we've got to ask ourselves, come back to the church, that our programs and our structures help us to return to what the church is all about, which is that place of encounter with God. Not a building. The building only serves the church. The church is not the building. Are you going to church today? Doesn't mean you're going to a building. It means you're going to gather with God's people. It's really important. And it's worth remembering that Jesus is met and encountered more than just one way, and that it isn't just that you encounter Jesus and you come into a church, you're part of his people, but you go on encountering Jesus. And church history should be the story of people encountering Jesus in all so many different ways. I would not have told the story about the Pope all those years ago, even though I was nurtured by a Catholic charismatic. But I tell that story now because Jesus encountered me in a pub in Jaranalka, in Prague, at Easter, as we move towards Easter, and I share with people and I find myself praying for the Pope. I don't think I prayed for the Pope very much before then, but I pray for him now, and I have the Pope app on my iPhone. And I read his biblical teaching, and it's phenomenal, and it's better exposition than many a sermon that I've heard from my good evangelical brothers and sisters. Powerful stuff. And I'm saying, how can that be? He's Catholic. How can that be? And it just reveals my prejudice. Church structures are important. They are programs that provide stability and continuity. Acts 2, they met together. This is like the early church. What do we do? We'll open the word. We'll share the word. Which wasn't a book, remember, in those days. It was actually telling the story. Let's tell the story. And they prayed together. As Jesus had taught them to pray, so they prayed together. And they met together in fellowship meals, and they broke bread, because that's what Jesus said they should do. They should break bread and drink of the cup in remembrance of him. And also they served, and the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Acts 2, 42 through 47. That's a bit of a structure and a program, and we should adhere to those things. We need to be people of the word. We need to be people who are seeking God in prayer. We need to be people who fellowship and who share together. We need to be men and women who kind of are folks of sacrament as well, that we remember bread and wine, and also that we serve. Those are stability things. But when those things become the be-all and end-all, we've missed what they actually are serving. Can you understand what I'm saying in that? The service is important, but it's not the service that's important. It's what the service is doing to help us to worship the true and the living God. And that, of course, is where the challenge kind of lies for us, that we mustn't institutionalize the structures so they become ends in themselves. All of them must serve the process of people encountering Jesus. And here's the missional challenge. Church taking out the heart of God into the world. I've mentioned Crossing Places, and we'll go for a coffee in a moment. Crossing Places was something that was born of a conversation that I had with a friend of mine called Bill Eukster, who was a pastor not a million miles away in Warrington. I'd known Bill from the 1980s because I was in the north side of the River Tees in a place called Portrack, Stockton, and he was at Berwick Hills in Middlesbrough. And then he went off to the south, and I stayed in the north, but we kept friends. Bill became a companion of the Northumbria community, and he would come up a couple of times a year, and we were having a conversation, and we were talking about really deep things at the coffee table. He's a Liverpool supporter, and I'm a Borough supporter, and, you know, we were just talking about the stuff of internal significance. You know, whether it was right for Dalgleish to come back and manage, you know, Liverpool, and it wasn't kind of stuff. And Borough, you know, I could, you know, I love supporting Borough. You know, we're not sponsored by any Russian billionaire. There's nothing corrupt or unjust. It's just we're a rubbish football team. But at least we have a community heart and we've got some good people. That was our conversation. 3 days later, a lady who I hardly know, I was back in the coffee shop just over the high street from where I live, and she said, I hope you don't mind, but I was kind of like earwigging on what you were saying with your friend the other day. It sounded really interesting. So we must have talked something more than Liverpool or Borough. And I said, yeah. She said, what does he do? I said, well, he's like a vicar, because she would understand that, because she wouldn't understand what a Baptist minister is. You know, he's like a vicar. Oh, right. And then she said something as I went out, just past the time. Wouldn't it be great if there was somebody like that here? She's not a Christian. She's not a churchgoer. Wouldn't it be good if there's somebody like that here? And I went out. And then I went on retreat and saw my spiritual director about 2 months later. A scary lady. Nun. Anglican nun. Try and get my life in order before I see her. Never works. And one of the things that she does with me twice a year is like reflect on what's gone on since we last met. Go into silence and see what emerges. And what emerged was the conversation with this woman. So on my retreat, I wrote a letter to Ian Bunce, who was then head of the mission of the Baptist Union. And I said, this is a vision. We need to plant the gospel. We need to replant the gospel in Glendale, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It came out of a conversation. Bless him, 10 days later, he's at our house. And 5 months later, we've called Bill Euxter to be a full-time missional pastor, to share the gospel. Not to plant a church, but to share the gospel. Well, bless him. Bill struggled for 2 years because he'd been a Baptist minister for nearly 30 years. He didn't know how to plant the gospel outside of not having a church. He used to be putting his coat on at 7:20 at night and there was nowhere to go. He was like really struggling. He didn't have meetings to organize. It was a real... And it's taken him to detox from that Christendom model to actually just being a pastor in the community. In the coffee shops. He's created Wooler Community Garden. We've set up a credit union. He's just available to talk to people. Government cutbacks has meant that our care home, the only care home in Glendale, an area that stretches 17 miles north-south and 11 miles east-west, the care home has shut. So every elderly person in Glendale who needs residential care has to go and live outside of where they've been born and brought up, spent the whole of their life. So they're in turmoil. And actually, some of them are just dying. Mortality rates have risen. So what does Bill do? He feels God's heart for the elderly. So he spends a lot of time with the elderly who are feeling forsaken. He has got considerably better at playing dominoes. He plays dominoes every Friday afternoon with a whole load of guys. And he travels 18 miles to take some of the guys who still live in Wooler and who are independent and on their own. And he takes them to the care home where 3 of the guys have actually been put 18 miles away. They live for Friday afternoons and the domino. And Bill used to struggle. He'd say, hey, I'm kind of getting a bit of a grant and people are supporting me for playing dominoes. And I'm saying, just relax. Play for money and you can pay it all back. But in that silly illustration, what we're trying to say is that we're rediscovering what it is to be church. Because we are church, even though we haven't planted a church. We are church. It's being Jesus in the world. And I think Jesus would be playing dominoes. I think Jesus would be providing a context where men could say, I'm lonely. I don't like it here. I'm living in a town. I've always lived in the country. When I look out my window now, I don't see fields and sheep. I just see another house across the way. Crossing places, we go for coffee. We have the phrase, sowing, forming and serving. Planting the gospel and sees what happens. I end with this story. Vincent Donovan, who wrote a fantastic book called Rediscovering Christianity. He was an evangelist in East Africa. And amazing stuff. He just used to go into an area and tell the Christian story, sow the seed of the gospel, give a few suggestions, and then he'd go away. I was like, I mean, American Baptists and Western organizations were askance at his methodology. You can't do that. What about the care? I just plant the gospel. It's got. And then he'd come back and he'd discover all these different expressions of how people had come to know Jesus, and the church looked like this, and one church looked like that, and some people did this, and some people did that. There was life all over the place. And I think what we need to learn in the church is, let's rediscover the power of the gospel. And not think that it's the church that has to be at the front. The gospel needs to be at the front. The church emerges out of the gospel. And I think that's important for those of you who are thinking about new and fresh expressions or planting. Plant the gospel, see what happens. Why it didn't work in Stockton with the big tabernacle church doing all the mission stuff on the council housing estate is they were trying to replicate what they had in the big church in the city centre, in the centre with all its resources and all its people and its choir and its youth and everything else. And they were trying to replicate it on the council housing estate. And they didn't understand. It's a different culture. They were trying to do it with teacups and saucers and didn't understand it. This is a mug culture. They're trying to do it by visiting people on the front doors. Well, front doors only get visited by funeral directors and insurance brokers who never get answered the door to. But the gospel, you see, reaches everywhere. Reaches everywhere. We'll explore what this actually might mean as we come back for coffee.